Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I am super fired up for this episode. This is the second start for this episode because we got to add on an extra guest, and we'll have more about that here in a second. Before we get on into that, though, we've got to bring up Sam Bradley, the co-hostess with the mostest.
I like it the way you did the first time, Jamie. It was much more profound. But hey, it's cold here again. We had a couple nice, really nice warm days, and now it's all gloomy and rainy, and they're even talking about snow, which I want to pick our meteorologist brains about. And we have them both on tonight, which is very cool. Mr. Kyle Nelson and Miss Becky DePodwin. And she's doing some interesting stuff we want to hear about. But first, Dr. Joe, you're down in Memphis. What's the weather like down there?
Absolutely spectacular. Hi, everybody. It's been a beautiful week, although we've got all that nasty stuff from the planes headed our way tomorrow. So we're enjoying it while we can.
Good. Well, we'll send it right over to you. And I think I'll go visit you for a couple of days. So, Mr. Kyle, what's up with the weather?
Oh, Sam, we got a lot going on with the weather coast to coast. Looking back, I had to go back over a week to find a day that didn't have a tornado or high wind report. So it's been an active week of weather on the plains, especially the south central and southeastern United States, with multiple tornadoes being reported each day. And as well as river flooding continuing for our friends and colleagues in the Midwest working in that regard. So, of course, these heavy bouts of rain from these thunderstorms are not helping with their situation. And now we also are getting the snow melt occurring with some warmer temperatures, at least currently, in Colorado and the high country. So rivers are filling quickly, and as well as mountain reservoirs. But, Sam, as you did mention, we do have a winter storm making its way through the northwestern part of the U.S. It's going to slide through Colorado tomorrow evening through the day on Friday. So we have that to look forward to, more snow in the mountains to keep those mountain reservoirs full and things green and wet, hopefully delaying wildfire season. And from there, looks like to be a active week of weather still for those convective weather hazards. So hail, severe winds, and tornadoes in the central and southern plains and on into the southeast as we go on throughout the week. And these storms will also bring a heavy rain threat to the southern Mississippi River Valley. That's a quick look at the weather from me.
Oh, my. Spring is just a crazy weather season. So Becky, anything you want to add to that? You're back east doing something interesting right now. We want to hear about that as well.
Yeah. So this week is actually hurricane preparedness week. And so there's a tour ongoing called the Hurricane Awareness Tour, and it's two Hurricane Hunter planes, a bunch of guys from the NHC, the National Weather Service, private company sponsors, all getting together at five different airports, along the Eastern Seaboard to talk about hurricane preparedness. They chose inland cities this year to kind of focus on the threat of flooding than actually on the coast from hurricanes. So trying to draw a lot of focus on that and make sure people are prepared and have a way to receive alerts and warnings and know what their risk is, flood insurance, all that good stuff. It was a really, really cool event today down in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I got to go on the Hurricane Hunter planes. Huge nerd moment. Really, really cool.
Oh, wow. We got to hear about that. Right, Jamie?
Definitely.
That'll be a lot of fun.
I'm excited to hear about it. And Becky, I saw some of the things you were posting on Twitter about that. That's why we always try to make sure folks know how to follow you guys.
Yep, we always know what Becky's doing, especially on Twitter. She's tweets her life up there, but it's always interesting stuff. So speaking of weather, I get the newsletter for the Weather Channel, and they came up with something quite interesting the other day called 7 Unreasonable Expectations About Weather Forecasts. And even though this is done a little bit tongue-in-cheek, it makes some very valid points that I think our meteorologists would love to dispel. The first one being, stop breaking into my TV show. And they mentioned that a meteorologist from Atlanta actually received a death threat because the meteorologist was warning about tornadoes during a golf tournament. And his point was, nobody has ever died missing a rerun of a golf tournament. So I guess that is somewhat annoying, but they don't usually break in, Kyle, without a really good reason, right?
Correct. Sometimes it is the station's choice to break in. Other times, there are actually requirements from the FCC to push out weather information and official products from the National Weather Service, especially those severe weather warnings. Sometimes those can be done. You'll see what's called the crawl, just as the scrolling bar along the bottom of the screen. They might put the little animated weather map and the county map in the corner of the screen as well that cycles through things. But really, research has shown that a known, trusted face in your community that you watch on a regular basis, that person, the local TV meteorologist, can add so much value to the forecast and to that weather alert. Even if your area is not being affected, someone's is, and you would hope they'd do the same for you.
Good point. Becky, anything you want to add to that one?
No, I think Kyle summarized it really well. I think he's spot on.
Okay, the expectation of exactness. My daughter's wedding is on Saturday at 5 o'clock. Is it going to rain, Kyle?
Well, Sam, that's what everyone always wants to know. And this is this expectation is one that is, quite frankly, it's unrealistic. And you know, within the time frame, say like up to 12 hours in advance, sure, there can be some more specifics on the timing and all that. But as far as is a raindrop going to fall on my head at this time on this date at this location, that's where the challenge really falls into play. That's due to partially a limitation in our ability to forecast and model weather going forward in time at such high a detail. So down to like street level forecasting, right? It's not a real thing. It's a marketing ploy if you ever hear it. And second, it's also the expectation comes from, right? Well, my weather app says this, right? These weather apps, they show things hour by hour, but keeping in mind, those are also for a general area. And if you're watching the hour by hour weather on say a TV network, that's for an even larger general area. That's the viewing area, not necessarily where you physically are.
Good point. Jamie, you have a thought?
Well, I just know, like, even in my area, I have some pretty hilly terrain where I am, and I have literally driven up a hill, and it's been raining at the top of a hill and not at the bottom of the hill. So,
good point.
You know, the house at the bottom of the hill is just cloudy.
I've seen that happen.
You're right. There needs to be some reasonable expectations and understanding of the inexactness of what dealing with nature and its multitude of variables brings to the table. So,
and the poor meteorologists are always getting beat up about it. How about this one? It came without warning. Is that actually ever true, or are people just not paying attention, Kyle?
Well, Sam, there's quite a lot to unpack in that one alone. I'm going to toss this one to Becky to start.
It's pretty rare that something will actually come without warning. I think most of the time people are very caught off guard. This is where I'm going to throw out the term personal responsibility. If you truly did not receive any warning, it's probably because you had no way to receive that warning. Either you didn't have your phone app set up to receive warnings, you weren't paying attention to the TV or the radio. The National Weather Service is phenomenal at what they do, and it's very, very rare that a major storm or any kind of event will actually occur without warning. So it's one of those things. Just if you don't understand your risk. If it's going to be a day with storms, have a way to receive those warnings, have more than one way to receive those warnings. I don't think it's a really a fair thing to say that things come without warning, because I just don't think it happens very often.
Yeah, like I love your statement, personal responsibility, and that goes along with paying attention. So this kind of leads into the apps. Is relying on the weather apps, Kyle, something that's good, bad, or maybe taken with a grain of salt?
Well, it depends on what your need is that those apps are addressing. If it's looking very generally, perhaps, for say, should I bring an umbrella or not? Or what should I dress my kids in if they're standing out at the bus stop? Right. In that case, a weather app could be very helpful for just a quick glance. But if you're looking to really drill down, and if you're using this when, especially for on the private sector side, I'll give an example. I was out tower climbing today doing radio installations on our mountaintop sites. And there was a discussion between some of my colleagues with, oh, you know, well, my app says it's going to rain this afternoon. Well, no, mine says it's going to be clear. And now you get this conflicting information because these apps, many of them, if, you know, majority of them, do not have any human input. It's cherry picking one model run, one computer model run, and putting the numbers out. And so it's not taking into account all those little nuances, the local variations. And also, like, again, that hour by hour, that's still being pulled straight from a model. No human that understands the local weather patterns has often ever touched that piece of information. Now, on the other side, apps can be incredibly helpful when it comes to receiving those weather alerts and notifications from the National Weather Service, as well as from your local agencies as well, like emergency management and other entities that help to keep you safe by pushing messages out to you.
Becky, anything to add on that?
Yeah, just to Kyle's points of many weather apps not having the human touch, I can't speak for other weather apps, but I do know for a fact that the AccuWeather app and the AccuWeather forecast algorithm is a blend of many different models. We take in a lot of data globally, and we do have humans looking at it all the time.
Yes, and I agree. I really like the AccuWeather app, so we'll give them some kudos here. Anomalies are anomalies. And Kyle, with all the strange weather patterns we've had, oh, my God. I mean, you just never know what to expect. 500-year storms happening twice a month. I mean, is that now an expectation, the anomalies?
Well, anomalies, again, we are very good as a society, as human beings, and looking back on what has happened. And the expectation always says, oh, if it's happened in the past, we can expect the same trend to continue into the future. Right, that's persistence forecasting, and also a little optimism in there. But as our climate continues to change, and these weather systems that we have continue to grow in intensity and severity, and also the impacts becoming amplified due to humans being more spread out and also more reliant on, you know, basic services, as well as being in hazard areas, we're seeing what may have at one time been a routine weather event now becoming an anomaly because of the impacts that it causes. Now, on the anomaly side as well, I love the example that's shared here in this article, Sam, where you have over 50 inches of rainfall being forecast with Hurricane Harvey in the Houston area, right? For a hurricane to move through, typically it will continue to move very quickly, even after it loses its tropical characteristics, even after it makes landfall, so on and so on. But when the model started hinting at this, it was up to the human forecaster to really diagnose, is this a one-off thing? Is this model going crazy? Or are we actually expecting the storm to slow and drop prolific amounts of rainfall over one area for this amount of time? So the weather models don't handle the extreme events very well, but the human forecaster's touch on events like that, that's what really helped to bring it out. And I'll tell you, when you have to start adding color bars or adding, you know, finding new ways to describe these weather phenomena, they may not be just anomalies. They may be things that we should expect to be living with in the future.
Kind of the new normal.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, I think Becky would agree. You just have to be prepared for anything, because that's about what we get these days. And finally, folklore doesn't trump science. So can we depend on the red sky and morning sailors take warning thing that we all learned as kids? Kyle?
I mean, actually, that one's...
Oh, there you go. Becky, go ahead.
That one's actually pretty spot on.
I know.
I struggle with the actual explanation of it, but it has something to do with the way the light is refracted through the clouds, and if it's in the west versus the east, but it's actually pretty accurate. Like, I don't know if Kyle has a better explanation, but that's one folklore that does hold true.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. So the red sky in the morning, sailors take warning. Looking off, and with to the east there, as the sun rises, if that weather system has moved through, then you're able to see that with the dust that's in the air, that's what gives the sky the reddish hue, all these different dust and particles and soot and things. And it's these wind events that stir up these dust particles, and those will often occur ahead of an approaching storm system. Now, if it's at night, it's off to the west, well, that means that it's not quite to you yet, and so you'll be able to have a little bit more time before that weather system reaches you.
Good stuff, you guys. So I want to move into phase two here, but one of the things that I like to do every once in a while, which we kind of forget about, is people knowing who we are and what we do, and kind of reintroducing ourselves. So for tonight, I'm going to focus on the meteorologist. So Kyle, I want folks to know who you are and what you do, and then we'll have Becky do the same thing.
Awesome. Well, hey, folks, Kyle Nelson here, coming to you from Aspen, Colorado. I serve in a couple different roles here, but my background is as a meteorologist and with also experience in emergency management and public safety. I currently apply these as a mountain weather forecaster and winter X Games coordinator on Buttermilk Mountain for working for Aspen Ski Company, as well as a weather and social media decision support specialist with Epicenter Media and Training.
Becky?
Yeah, so I'm Becky DePodwin. I'm a meteorologist at AccuWeather. I have a master's in emergency management. My focus is really on the communication aspect of severe weather and forecasting and communicating risk to the public and how we can shape that message to prompt people to take action, to take personal responsibility, to know where to receive warnings, how they should act in all kinds of weather disasters.
Valuable stuff for both of you. Well, before we jump into our main topic, I do want to mention a couple hours ago here in Colorado, we did have another school shooting, and seven kids were shot. My cousin, who's a doctor in Denver, very close to that area, has been kind of tapped into the medical side and let me know where everybody went. And it looks like there were no fatalities, at least certainly so far, but she's keeping me up to date on that. And there were two suspects that they caught. I think they were looking for a third. So here we go again, Joe. There's just no escaping that, is there?
Yeah, really, really sad. I think what is notable, though, is the dramatic difference in response between this incident and Columbine, which is 20 years ago and about 20 miles away from there. And that is that law enforcement responded immediately. They went in actively hearing shots, and they went in to try to get things stopped. It's my understanding from the news reports I've seen that several students actually were responsible for taking down the shooters and stopping the assault. I don't know any details on that at all yet, but nevertheless, it's just a tremendous change in approach in the last 20 years. And thankfully, in this case, at least, there's no fatalities, and hopefully everybody that was injured will recover completely.
Yeah, I found that interesting, too, that it was so close. In fact, I was in Littleton only like a week before Columbine happened. And it's interesting, too, I hadn't heard the part about the students taking down the shooters, but maybe they're getting tired of being victims. So,
well, and that's also goes back to the training they're getting in schools now, which is that, you know, you run if you can, you hide if you don't have an option, and if nothing else, if there's no place to hide and nowhere to run, then you fight. You go to, you attack the shooter because you don't have a choice. And we saw that happen in the shooting at the college in North Carolina not too long last week. That individual was credited with stopping the attack. Even though it took his life, he probably saved many others. And I think that This sounds like it might be the situation that's the same. And if that's the case, then the training these students are getting, which sad to say we have to give them that training, but the training these students are getting is making a difference. And that's good to hear. Wouldn't you agree, Joe?
I absolutely would. Yes, I am certainly encouraged by the educational programs that have been put in place. It will be interesting to read the after action on this one and see if we can tie together the impact of those educational programs there with the outcome of this one versus the outcome of the ones in the past.
Very true. Kyle, you called that RHF. Is that the mnemonic for run, hide, and fight?
Yeah, that was like a quick brain dump into the chat box.
So, Kyle, we're going to talk about dispatching and one of the many things you do. And I'll ask you some general questions about that. But what interested you in taking a position in a 911 dispatch center?
Well, Sam, my career with emergency management and public safety and really meteorology began with amateur radio. Back in Allegan County, Michigan, I was introduced to amateur radio by the boss of the place I was working at the time. He had the antenna farm on his roof, and it's like, hey, what's that all about? You talking to aliens? He's like, no, come here. So he showed me all the cool things ham radio could do, and he said, oh, by the way, we're also Skywarn spotters, and we go out and observe weather and report back during high-impact events. Well, I thought that was pretty darn cool because I had had a weather interest from a young age, and from there, I got involved with local emergency management, mostly on the communication side, supporting both cash radio supplies as well as communications, network, and telecom type things during pre-planned events within the county and surrounding jurisdictions. Fast forward until now, going to college, getting the weather degrees, and then coming out here to Colorado, I started doing radio tower work and installation in the summertime. So instead of climbing lift towers like I do with ski patrol, I do radio towers here in the summer. And the position opened up at dispatch, and it was said that I could have opportunities outside the center as well to grow and to assist with our local events, similar to what I did back home. And I jumped at the opportunity because I think it's been a fantastic way for me to really contribute more locally as well, and integrating my weather knowledge and EM side into the operations and the policies in the dispatch center.
Oh, good deal. Well, there's a lot of different kinds of dispatch centers, and they vary, of course, depending on large areas, small areas, rural, urban, and that kind of thing. But, you know, to kind of just keep it in a nutshell, it's not just one dispatcher usually, it's several, and you have call takers versus radio operators, right?
Correct. So the term dispatcher, it's pretty ambiguous, and it really depends on where you go. You know, dispatch, really, if you think of a dispatcher, just in your mind, those of you that are listening and those hosts, just think of a dispatcher in your mind, right? Is it from, you know, Rescue 911, like you heard on TV? Is it from the, you know, other TV shows, or perhaps people that you've interacted with professionally? In dispatch centers, they can be of an all-in-one type center, so they do and handle law, fire, and EMS or medical calls, all flooding into one center, and they're trained to handle those, and also dispatch them via radio as well. And that's what our center is like here in Colorado, and many of them are in the mountain communities, because we don't have the luxury of having dispersed centers like in the big cities, where if it's say in Denver, some of the different jurisdictions, if it's, you know, they'll answer the phone, 911, police, fire, or medical. And based on the description that the caller gives, they may either hang on to it if it's a law call, or transfer it to a medically trained dispatcher if it's a fire specific or EMS specific call. So that's how those are broken out. But increasingly, really, Sam, I don't think the word dispatcher does it justice. We are really not just telecommunicators either, but even going so far as to be emergency communication specialists, with the amount of information that we're processing and the tasks that we're performing beyond just answering the radios and the telephones.
Well, that actually is a good segue to my next question, because we have these days END and tier dispatching. You had to go through a special course of training, and what you do is extremely important in terms of knowing, of course, you know, having a medical background is helpful, but if somebody calls in the middle of an emergency and there's something they can do, you won't just turf them to somebody else. You're going to stay on the line and help them figure out how to help their person, right?
Absolutely. And historically, and this may have been the case, some of you may have experienced this living in very rural areas. You may have heard a story from friends that it used to be if you called 911 and there was a medical emergency, we could give, the dispatcher could give general instructions. And it was, okay, hold on, they're on their way, they're on their way. And that's about as far as it went. Fast forward, and as you hinted at, Sam, the acronym you used was EMD, or Emergency Medical Dispatch. That is a 3-day training course that trains our dispatchers to give life-saving emergency medical instructions, or pre-arrival instructions, as we call them, before the EMTs or paramedics would arrive on scene. And you have 33 chief complaints, as we call them. So based on 911, what's the address of the emergency? What's the phone number you're calling me from? Okay, tell me exactly what happened. From the narrative, the short narrative they give, you picked out a chief complaint. There's some additional questioning that then happens, and then specific instructions we can give based on what may be ailing that person, whether it's if you're calling as a first person, if you're calling on behalf of someone, say a second person, then we can do everything from one of my partners actually 3 weeks ago on a graveyard shift actually helped a lady and her husband deliver a baby in their house before the paramedics got there. They lived in a very rural part of our jurisdiction, and he was able to give those instructions all the way from preparing to delivering the baby and making sure it was breathing and all that. We've given CPR instructions. We can, you know, choking, bleeding control, and many, many other things, even administering Narcan, talking you through how to use different types of auto injectors for Narcan as well.
So you guys are truly the first of the first responders. And I think that's been underappreciated for a long time. Jamie, any thoughts from you on that so far?
Well, I think that it's important to just, I think as a responder, to remember that they are, like you said, the first responders, that they are part of the team. And it's something that, I think that some people still struggle with these days. They're just the guys on the radio telling us what to do, and maybe they get it right, maybe they get it wrong, and you know, they kind of blow it off. But it, in my estimation, and I've always felt this way, is probably the toughest job out there. I can't imagine how difficult emotionally it must be to remain calm and in a situation where you are totally helpless to do anything but render aid with your voice. At least when we're on the scene, we can take physical action to stop the bleed, to begin CPR, to do life-saving measures in that sense where we can actually see a response to our efforts and make changes and adjustments in that situation. To have to do that over the phone would scare the heck out of me, and it's not something that I would desire to do at all. And I think we don't give our dispatchers enough credit. And I'm sure Joe would back me up on that, because I think that it's something we need to probably do more to include dispatch in our planning and training efforts.
Yeah, Joe, I'm sure you have some thoughts on this, being an ER doc and knowing this is where it all starts.
Oh, I do indeed. I think Jamie touched on many of the positive aspects here. And again, as Jamie said, the impact that the 911 dispatcher can have on not only the individual call, but on the system in general is huge. They are the ultimate resource management person. If you push that to the disaster realm, then
really having an appreciation for someone who really understands the importance of that job and their ability to set public expectations, provide information, provide instruction, and get the right resource to the right location at the right time is a phenomenal multitasking effort that requires training, understanding, technical and electronic tools to help us do that. And that doesn't even touch on things like, nurse dispatch issues and redirection programs and efforts to offload the 911 system from calls that don't need to be in the 911 system in the first place. So it is a massive job, a massive undertaking, and as has been clearly stated before, I think tremendously underappreciated for the impact that those folks have on the system in general.
Well, it just poses a question I just thought of, Joe. When you get patients in the ER from the 911 system, does it get translated to you that the dispatcher may have had a major role in what occurred before the crews got there?
No, usually not. I'm in a very unique position as an EMS medical director to be able to see the backside of all that, but the dispatch piece is very rarely incorporated into the information that's transferred when the patient is delivered to the ED. Occasionally, the crew will let you know that, CPR was done by a family member at the direction of the dispatcher, but it's fairly rare, and I think that we do not do a good job in tying that whole chain of events together so that we can truly appreciate the number of people it takes to respond to emergencies and to make certain that we're doing the right thing for our patients.
Well, and especially since you're so involved in CPR research, I imagine having that piece of information would be invaluable, especially when there's a good outcome. Everybody should get credit for that.
There's no question about that. We have an event here in Tennessee called the Star of Life that is an effort to recognize and reward 911 responders for their life-saving heroism. And when we do that, we try to bring together the person that made the call in the first place, the victim or the patient, as it were, as well as everyone in that chain. And we particularly try to include the 911 dispatcher in there as part of that whole recognition process, because, as we've already said, I think that they are greatly underappreciated for the role that they do.
And people can see they actually are a living, breathing human being, not just a voice, a disembodied voice. Becky, any thoughts from you so far?
You guys have already touched on it a little bit, but I would just be curious if any studies have ever been done on the mental health impacts of being a 911 dispatcher and that first responder. I mean, they take in these calls, hear these people who are going through a traumatic event, and then it's just sort of left, and do they know what happens? Is there follow-up? Did they have PTSD from some really severe cases? I'd just be curious what the mental health impact of it all is.
Yes, and that's definitely one of the things I wanted to focus on. But since you brought it up, Kyle, you want to jump with that?
Yes. And I think it's been very, very awesome to hear from those of us here on the show today that understand the role that the 911 dispatcher plays in this whole process. But for those of you, and Becky, thank you for bringing up the mental health aspect. It's something that is, I still, from the stories that I hear from other centers, it's only still just being realized and programs implemented in order to address this, these traumatic, these stress injuries and things like this that we've had. So for those, just for full transparency, I started out, doing ski patrol, the EMT side of things on the mountainside, and have, done CPR head saves on the mountainside, but now taking it, on a phone call, your mind is your own worst enemy, because you only have as much information as the background noise and the caller gives you. So I think about it as, and I keep referencing the show Rescue 911 because William Shatner, of course, is amazing. But second of all, if you watch that show and you do it, just they play some of the actual calls, the voice recordings from 911. Watch it with the blindfold on as it's being narrated, as some of these, again, it is a reenactment, but just think about it, what in your mind is happening, and then rewatch the same episode, but actually seeing kind of, again, a reenactment, but your mind takes you to some of the darkest places based on what you hear. And, you know, with the mental health side of it, a lot of times we do not get that closure. We disconnect. Oh, hey, the first responders are here. Okay, I'm going to let you go so they can further assist you. And we're on to the next call, the next thing, the next traffic stop. Life doesn't just stop. We can take a few seconds to process that, but then we have to jump right back in. There isn't that intermission. There isn't that break in between calls all the time. And so it does take a toll. And I've seen it in my supervisors at my center. I've seen it in friends and colleagues who have had mental health crises because of both acute as well as chronic stress injury from on the job, hearing the stories. Because folks, I don't care if it's an emergency line like a 911 or a non-emergency line, people don't call us because they're having a good day. They need something, they want something, or they're having the worst day of their lives, and we're hearing that every time. So just imagine listening to that.
You're right. And having done dispatch QI for a very large fire department dispatch center, I listened to hours and hours and hours of those calls and just trying to imagine not only the fact that the dispatcher has a very difficult call, but there's all the other things going on around them as well. But that kind of leads into something else, and I think that's kind of where Joe is going, is when you have an emergency in the field, a wildland fire, and you don't know what happened to your guys, you can't get in contact with them. This is more the fire side, of course, but that could be law enforcement, that could be EMS. You guys take a hit on that because, you, like Joe said, you don't have any direct control. You don't know where your people are. You think something could have happened, and people may forget to get back to you on the outcome.
Absolutely. And we are very fortunate in our center. We're relatively small, but we are incredibly busy for the populations that we have, especially with seasonal tourism and things here in the Aspen area in the Central Mountains of Colorado. Our agencies, I will say, the most recent that I can recall that really rocked a lot of us pretty significantly was New Year's Eve. We had a triple overdose in a hotel in town, two of which were ended up passing away. But it was one of the more serene moments that I've experienced in the center, where two of the dispatchers are both giving CPR instructions, and then one person that particular night was left to manage all law and fire and EMS traffic on the radios. And so very quickly, you know, that overwhelmed us, and it truly kind of set the tone. But from there, I will say that their agencies that responded were fantastic in following up with us on the next shift. They came in, we called them that night and let us, you know, say, hey, can you just give us the quick run through, once you got there, what did you see? How did this evolve versus how we thought it evolved in our heads? And then actually having a sit down and going through those processes of, you know, talking about it and kind of playing it forward, and to be invited to that, to be included in that, it's rare for some centers, but for us, I'm very happy to say that is something that our agencies take very seriously.
I agree. Now hear this, everybody out there, don't forget the dispatchers. And if they're too busy to come to a debriefing or a diffusing, if you have those, at least send somebody into the dispatch center to sit down with the people that were most affected by this. Jamie, you have some thoughts?
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, it's something that I made a point to do whenever there was what I thought was a difficult call or a call with a lot of, you know, a lot of moving parts that had to work together a certain way to make it come to an optimal outcome. It's something I learned working in an ER setting for a while, and I'm curious to see if this is something that Joe's had experience with as well. Just, you know, when you know, having that time where you pull the people together involved with a situation, and just, you know, doing a quick rundown of what worked, what didn't work, real quick, and you know, give them a positive outlook of you did the best you could do. We're going to follow up on this and find out more information. But it never occurred to me in all the times I've done that to include dispatch in that process. And, you know, looking back on it now, it's something that would have been at least easy to do if they were available, to get them on the speakerphone and just let them listen in, or to include them in a more formal process later on. So, you know, that's something I learned and carried over into the field with me. And I think that it's something that others do as well, but we should remember the entire process from top to bottom.
That's true. And I want to go to Joe here. But one of the things I've always believed, having worked the dispatch side and the field side and the training, is I think all first responders need to spend some time in the dispatch center to get an idea of what they go through. There's so much misconception in the field about what dispatchers do and why they do it and why they get grumpy once in a while, and vice versa. The program I tried to work on was sending the dispatchers out for ride-alongs so they could see what life was like on the engine. So I think that's kind of an invaluable part of the training. Plus, I get to know the people a little better. Joe, thoughts on that?
Oh, I think you said that beautifully, Sam. It absolutely is a very unique environment, a very challenging environment. You know, I think one of the things that I hear a lot from crews in the field is their frustration, which is not exactly the right word, but that's how it comes across. With we got sent on this call that was, you know, we were told was a 27 Charlie 3 or whatever the code was, and it was a chest pain call, and we got there and the guy had back pain, and you know, I spent a lot of time trying to explain to them, you know, look, I'm not really as interested in whether or not it was back pain or chest pain. I'm really just interested to know, were we able to at least match up the appropriate amount of resources for this call versus what you found when you got there? Understanding that people call in with all kinds of absurd complaints and they embellish their complaints. And, you know, those that have called more than once know that if they say they got chest pain, they'll come faster, you know. So everybody's not everybody, but you know, some people are gaming the system, et cetera. And to me, it's much less about did I get it correct with chest pain or back pain than it is did we accurately send the right level of resources to this call. And I think if we can get our guys in the field to really appreciate that's really what matters at dispatch, then we've really made some progress toward better managing our systems.
Good point. And to Kyle's earlier point, the information they have is only as good as the reporting party that's given it to them. And so people can be in a complete panic. They can understate things. They can overstate things. So they're not going to give the first responders exactly what they need. I mean, it's their job to go in and figure that out, because a lot of times it isn't accurate, but it isn't the dispatcher's fault. Yeah, they take what they're given and they send the right resources based on that information. Right, Kyle?
Absolutely, Sam. Like you said, always only as good as the information that we get from the caller, who sometimes can, you get the two extremes. It can be, well, I'm not sure this is an emergency, but, you know, my friend, he said he's got feeling clammy and he's had this weird, like this dull pain in his chest all day, but, you know, he figured I just want to call and check, you know, versus someone calling absolutely hysterical because they, you know, wake up in the morning and their significant other is laying next to them, now not breathing. So you can have the two extremes. And then keeping that all in mind with centers that take non-emergency calls as well, I could hang up from a CPR call, and the next call I take is someone who wants to file a complaint and speak with an officer about their neighbor's dog who's been barking for the last half hour.
Oh, I know that one, and it's really hard to deal with some of that stuff. So, Kyle, we got to wrap here pretty quick, but is there anything else you would want people to know about dispatchers and what they do and how they contribute to the whole?
I think the biggest thing is understanding, first and foremost, if you dial 911 by accident, you try to push the volume button on your phone, but you hit the power button instead and it starts dialing, just stay on the line. Talk to us. Tell us it was an accident. That saves us typically about 2 minutes trying to get back a hold of you because it was a 911 hang-up call. Second is that there's a human behind some of the questions that you'll get, especially on a medical. Sometimes it can sound robotic, but it's questions that have been proven time and time again to be very, very helpful to improve the outcome of the call for the person who's injured or ailed, as well as to be able to give our responders the best information. And finally, I think that the biggest thing is, you know, if you're listening to this in any part of the chain of survival on the medical side of things, or even on the first response side, definitely be sure to stop in regularly and visit dispatch, because things may change, policies may change. If you have questions about it, you can speak with those on the operations floor and see kind of what it's like and how that's integrating into the system. Because at the end of the day, you know, we have to work together as a team. So not just those of us in the field, but all the auxiliary agencies that dispatch will alert or bring into the picture, as well as all of our partners. And we can't do it alone. We have to do it together. And so I know a lot of times it's just supervisors that come and sit in at dispatch. I don't care if it's a jail deputy. I don't care if it's just a road deputy, whatever. However you are, if you are a part of a first response agency in any capacity, you should understand where that information starts, and that's in dispatch.
Yes, all the way around, communication is a wonderful thing. So, Jamie, we've touched a lot on the need for education in all of this, about and for and taking appreciation of our dispatchers. It always comes back down to training, doesn't it?
It does. And I'm curious to hear from Joe. You know, do you put in that fog of information into your scenarios when you guys are putting things together for Paragon Medical Education Group?
Yeah, we certainly do. I think that's part of the challenge that folks, especially that are fairly novice to disaster response, and I think particularly about hospitals and the way they respond, they tend to pencil whip it in many cases. And, you know, their response is, well, we'll just call in all our extra staff. And then you say to them, but all the cell phones are down. And how are you going to do that, right? How are people going to get here? The bridges are all out. You know, they just never have thought about it that far. So it's absolutely an important part of the whole planning process.
And that kind of just underlines, I think, how customizable your setup is and what you can bring to the table for an organization or a jurisdiction or a county or whatever the case may be. Where can folks get a hold of you, and what would be the top question you'd want to hear from them when they do call?
We would love to talk to people. The education that we offer is premium level stuff and very customizable based on their needs. So we would want to talk with them so that we have a good understanding of what it is we can do to help them achieve their goals. They can certainly find us at ParagonMedicalGroup.com or on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group as well. And they can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast.
Well, and we thank you all for your continued support of this show. Folks, you know, you're listening to this podcast because of the foresight and the vision of folks like Joe and Jim at Paragon Medical Education Group who said, you know, we want to be part of the information going out to disaster responders at all levels and positions. And you're hearing this because of that that vision. And so, you know, make sure you keep them in mind when training time comes around, when budgeting is done, when all that stuff happens, because they are a resource that I think will be invaluable to your system. Becky, where can folks find you if they want to find out more about what kind of fun stuff you've been up to this week?
Yeah, so I'm, as always, on Twitter, WX underscore Bex. Today I was at the Hurricane Awareness Tour, so I tweeted some pretty cool pictures of the Hurricane Hunter planes. Other than that, I'm usually just tweeting weather and whatever else is going on.
Great. And thanks for coming on tonight. I know you were kind of running around, but it was great to have you come on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, as always.
Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social media places under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. So feel free to connect with me there and continue the conversation, as well as in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group.
And thanks for really opening up, sharing some of the things that you've experienced and some of the things you want us to learn about dispatchers tonight. It's been really, really important to talk about that.
Absolutely. I really appreciate it. And, I'd like to give props and a shout out to another podcaster. His name is Ricardo Martinez, and he was an 911 dispatcher for 13 years, including serving in Allegan County, Michigan, where I grew up in. He started a podcast called Within the Trenches, and that really seeks to share the stories of 911 dispatchers nationwide and their struggles, their trials, their tribulations, as well as the successes. So if you want a little bit more on this, Within the Trenches is the podcast to follow.
Awesome. Sam, how about you?
Well, you can find me in the usual social media places on Facebook and Twitter and wherever else under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. And Kyle, your guy sounds like somebody who would make a good interview for this show. So let's talk about that. Certainly in our Disaster Podcast Facebook group, which is still growing, and on the disasterpodcast.com website. Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle Podmedic in most social media locations out there. So please friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with what I'm doing out there in all of the social media channels. And also make sure you catch up with me over on our Facebook group or over at disasterpodcast.com. We have easy ways for you to subscribe to every episode if you want, depending on what your mobile device of choice is, or even by email if you want. So find those links right there on each episode page and click that link, depending on your device or method of choice, and it will get you hooked up with how to subscribe to the show. And we want you to do that, so please take the time and make the effort. Sam, I love doing these things. I liked what you did with having Becky and Kyle introduce themselves a little bit and familiarizing themselves with them with the rest of the audience. There's a lot of people that have joined the show recently that haven't really been there since we first introduced them, and it's nice to be able to revisit that. So good idea there.
Well, and we'll catch up with the rest of us on a subsequent show. I just didn't want to do a whole half hour of introductions, but Kyle was our special guest tonight, and Kyle, I really appreciate what you had to say. You surprised me in a couple things that I didn't even think about, so thanks for doing that, and I hope it feels good to you to have gotten some of those important points out to everybody. But, Jamie, this is something a little bit different, but maybe we can say that disaster communication is not our everyday communication.